So, Michael Spring, you are Fodor's editorial director. Let's talk about the pronunciation again. What kind of name is Fodor?
Fodor's is a Hungarian name. Eugene Fodor founded the Fodor Empire 53 years ago. He's Hungarian and began with some books for Europe and then moved to the United States and developed a line of books so that now we have 140 titles and are the largest line of travel books in the country.
And you're the editorial director?
Yes, for 2 years since Random House took over.
What does an editorial director do?
Editorial
that makes travel guides.
Editorial director dreams of ways of making books even better than they have been. But under Random House, we've been given license to do everything necessary to make these books appropriate for a new breed of travel writer. And we've spent over $1 million on new computerized maps, some 2,100 of them for all our guides. We've developed a new format with numbers and legends so that you can move effortlessly between maps and texts and improve the quality of writing. The essays in the new Alaska book, for instance, has a Michener essay and a John McPhee piece, and trying to get beyond the notion that travel writing is hack writing, which it doesn't have to be. It doesn't have to be promotional. It doesn't have to be fluff. It could be good, serious, sophisticated, witty writing, and that's essentially what, as editorial director, I'm trying to do. We have a program. We've changed all the covers at once, but the actual rewriting of the guides will take several years, and those are in a new format with new priorities.
Well, let's go back and look at the Fodor travel guides historically. How did they come about? Where did they originate?
Well, again, they were the brainchild of Eugene Fodor,
mm-hmm.
and he began with a small group of European titles.
In Hungary?
He had an office in England, and he frankly has not been with Fodor's since the early 60s. He sold his rights in the company and has been an advisor. He's in his 80s. He's a very lively, you know, witty, sharp man who
probably reads the guides still, too.
Yeah, and he's very excited with what we're doing, and he's our best promotion. He's at all the ASTA conventions spreading the gospel according to Fodor's, and a very vigorous man. But it was his vision that got these books going. Essentially what they've done, which no other guides do, is combine service material, hands-on material that you will use as you're walking around a town, with lots of background information, essays, essentially a good read, something to curl up with. And it's those two elements together in one book which I think defines the Fodor's formula for success.
I noticed in some of the press material that was sent over that one of his early books, I think, was Europe, 1937. I mean, that travel guide had to go out of date very rapidly, huh?
Yes, it's the first of his books, and in fact it was reissued on the 50th anniversary as a very colorful period piece. But the books are updated every year, 140 titles, and keeps us busy.
So, I would imagine during the war there was a suspension of the guides, huh? Of course, this was long before your time.
Well, since this is not live, I can give you an honest response, which is that I've been with the company for 2 years, and I really don't know as much as I should about the history of the books. And what happened during the war is an interesting question, which I will get an answer to, but I don't know the answer to it now.
Yeah, well, it is kind of interesting to look at the historical perspective of travel guides and how they develop. Do you have any knowledge of the earliest travel guides, say those in the 19th and 18th centuries?
Well, the earliest guides, I mean, they were guides to the Roman catacombs in the 9th century, which the first pilgrims were taking with them. I suppose you can argue that the Odyssey was a travel book for sailors. The earlier guides were essentially lists of information, and really did not have the color and personality that guides today are trying to inject into their copy. I think if there's any change, it's been in the type of American traveler, who is much more sophisticated and independent and critical than an earlier breed of traveler. He's been around. He doesn't like to be led blindly. He likes enough information to make up his own mind about where he wants to go. He wants to be led off the beaten track. He doesn't want to feel part of a herd, and in many cases doesn't want to rub suitcases with strangers. And our new guides are trying to satisfy that new market.
Now, you mentioned it a moment ago. How many guides, I can't remember, how many guides do you publish?
We have 140 guides.
Wow.
And about 120 of them are updated every year.
They go out of date fairly fast, don't they?
Well, there's a lot of hotel and restaurant information, which changes from year to year, which is why it's important to update guides. I would say that none of the other guides are updated every year. Most of them, you'll see, have a two-year dateline on them. So the material at the end of that second year is over 3 years out of date.
You would be uncomfortable using a guide over 2 years, wouldn't you?
Well, that's why we're expending the money we do to produce annual books. It's a nightmare to think of redoing 140 books every year, but if you're all you have to sell is your credibility, and so accuracy is one of the top priorities of the new Fodor's administration under Random House.
I imagine the way our currency fluctuates, that's another major headache for a travel writer, huh?
Well, that affects the sales of any given title. But when you have 140 guides covering the whole world, if 1 year the France book doesn't sell, people will be buying twice as many guides to Australia or Mexico.
But in terms of prices, like restaurant prices and hotel prices, I mean, there's a great fluctuation in the cost, isn't there, because of the ups and downs of the international currency?
There is, and because of that, it would really be misleading to give exact prices, and any guidebook that does really is misleading people, because by the time you get there, those prices change. What we've done is develop a formula with categories from inexpensive to moderate to very expensive, so at least you know the relationship of one property to another, and we give price ranges, and those ranges stay fairly constant.
Now, who actually does the research and writing for these travel guides?
Well, we have some 300 freelance writers all over the world. It's our policy to hire people who live in the areas they write about. You can't go on a press trip and say anything very meaningful about a destination. So only an insider can lead a tourist down a back street to a restaurant that only local people know about. It's a logistical nightmare staying in touch with these people and communicating with them, but it's the only way you get sort of insider information that travelers want.
Is there any kind of backup that you use to make sure that the information is accurate?
Well, we do have fact checkers, and writers build up a reputation, and we do everything possible to make sure that the material is up to date.
Of course, there's a lot of information that doesn't have to be updated. Some of the essays, planning the trip. Some of the planning the trips, many of these are standard from one guide to another, isn't that
sure?
Correct?
And we don't have an obsession with changing things for the sake of changing them. If something is valid from 1 year to the next, such as an essay on historic Toronto, we may leave it in for 3 or 4 years. But the service material all has to be redone from scratch.
Do you travel a lot?
I'm afraid I spend most of my life these days orchestrating other people's adventures. If I had my way, I'd be on the road more than I am, but I am a inveterate traveler and love to be going from here to there.
I assume when you do travel, you use the Fodor's travel guide.
Well, I do, unless I'm doing something like hiking up at the Arctic.
You hike in the Arctic?
Well, I did last summer with my kids, and this past summer...
You can do that? You can actually hike in the Arctic?
Well, we were actually hiking south to the Arctic Circle through what was then Canada's northernmost national park. And the only guidebook was our senses and our sense of survival. This past summer, we were hiking through the High Atlas Mountains with Berber guides.
Where are those mountains?
the High Atlas Mountains of Morocco.
Ah.
And there were apparently no Americans had ever been there before. But I do enjoy that sort of offbeat vacationing. But I'm also happy staying in a very comfortable hotel in southern France or New England.
How did you get interested in travel books? How did you land this job, I guess, is what I'm asking.
Well, I've written two travel guides, one a book called A Great Weekend Escape Book, which is going to be coming out in a fourth edition, and another book for Doubleday called Great European Itineraries, and I've done a lot of freelance travel writing. And I guess when I was a college senior, I took a year off and hitched around the world at a time when the world was much more innocent than it is today.
Who are your biggest competitors?
Well, the biggest competitors,
Michelin is one, huh?
Michelin really isn't a major competitor because they only have a limited number of guides. The biggest competitor would be, I guess, Frommer. I mean, Frommer, Fielding, and Frommer are the three main competitors. The Frommer guides are essentially for a budget line of traveler. Our books are much more upscale and really have much more background cultural material, but those do satisfy a need.
Does Mobile still have their guides?
Mobile has its guides, but those essentially are lists of what's everything that's available. I think what I've discovered is that there's too much information out there, and there is a need for comprehensive lists, but the traveler today is overwhelmed by how much is available and needs somebody with good taste to tell him the good from the bad and to establish priorities and help him organize his time. So the Fodor's guides do try to behave like close, knowledgeable friends who take you aside and help you establish priorities. Those the Mobile guides really just throw all the information at you and say, good luck.
They're too big, anyway. I mean, I have found them useful in the past, but when you're traveling lightly to have to take these big books, it's kind of awkward.
Well, they're like a Yellow Pages. They serve a very definite function, but if you want to know which cleaners or shoe pad manufacturer is the best, the Yellow Pages isn't going to help you.
The Automobile Association's travel guides are pretty good. What I usually do when I travel, and I haven't been traveling very much in the last couple of years, but I would take a Fodor's guide, and I would take maybe a AAA guide. I might even have another guide that I won't take with me, but before I go, I'll compare the three. You can usually find out the best of everything by looking at three guides, because they generally reach a similar conclusion. That's a helpful thing for a traveler to do, don't you think?
Well, a growing number of travelers are reading, buying two or three books, and then picking out what they like best, because you can't assume that a travel writer's sensibilities are always your own. I must say one thing we're trying to do, and it's difficult, is to show travel writers how to avoid imposing their own sensibilities on readers, to describe something in such a way that what makes it unique is clear and the reader can make up his own mind. An example would be a writer being kind of young and often impoverished might say, avoid the Holiday Inn because it's boring. But that's not what our role is. The role would be to say, if you like Muzak or if you like the predictability and cleanliness of a motel, the Holiday Inn is great. If you like something that's softened by age and with lots of character, stay in a country inn, but leaving the final decision up to the reader.
Mm-hmm. Have you ever had a reader call you after coming back from a trip and complain and say, hey, you guys gave me a wrong steer?
Well, this is mostly for the old books, and it has happened. In fact, somebody sued us because he took his new bride to a hotel we recommended, and she had such a lousy time, she left him.
But, and he sued you?
Yes. He never appeared in court.
Think not.
But
isn't there a new phenomenon of these travel bookstores? There are a couple of travel bookstores in the city now, aren't there?
There are two in New York. It's one on 35th and Madison and another on 52nd Street. And they are both doing very well because Your average bookstore doesn't carry a full line of books, and the more independent traveler wants more than what many of the chains can offer. But what's happening is that travel bookshelves are crammed these days with different lines of books, and there are more and more every day, and there has to be a falling out at some point. And I suspect that the recognizable lines of books like Fodor's will be the ones that will survive.
Well, it was a shame that that Exxon closed their travel bureau. Remember that Exxon travel bureau they used to have in their building? You get free maps. Probably the only place in the country you get free road maps.
Sure, it was a time when you could pick up a wonderful road map at any gas station, and no longer. There was a time not too many years ago where you could just get free maps at any gas station in the country. Now they're all behind glass. And
you got to pay for them. Yeah. I had an uncle once who collected road maps, and he had one for all 48 states. He only had 48 states back in those days.
I love maps. I love to spread them out and put little red circles around places I want to go to and then get there.
Oh, reading maps, that's fascinating. And I love travel guides, too, because you sit there and just read them. I like to compare hotels and look at the restaurant listings and all of that.
So something that we've spent a lot of time on is improving the hotel and restaurant reviews. It seems to me that the success of a hotel spells the difference between a great vacation and a potential disaster. So we have a long questionnaire that all our writers have to fill out on hotels and restaurants. The hotel managers will often try and pass off a standard double as the wedding honeymoon suite. And so they're instructed to see at least three or four different properties. I'm sorry. Let's start this again.
Sure.
Okay.
This is all edited, so.
Yeah. What happens often is that a hotel manager will try and pass off the standard double as the honeymoon suite, and so our writers are all instructed to see three or four different rooms, and most hotels are constantly undergoing renovation, so they have to insist on seeing rooms that haven't been changed and those that have. And so far as restaurants are concerned, we have hired food critics in all the major cities of the world and set them loose to develop our dining reviews, because what happens in other travel guides is that, as a rule, some outsider comes in and with a list provided by a tourist office of restaurants and simply checks them out and really doesn't have the expertise to know really what's worth a visit.
But you don't actually pan restaurants, do you?
Well, it's interesting. There's so limited space in a travel guide that it doesn't make sense to knock a place. We might as well reserve that space for a place that's worth going. However, we get balanced reviews. If a somehow part of a hotel is run down, or if the steak is tough at a particular restaurant, we're free to say that.
Do you you must read other travel guides, don't you?
I do.
So you keep up with the travel guide industry. Have you been following the Zagat travel guides? I noticed he started doing travel guides as well as these restaurant reviews.
Now, Tim is an old classmate of mine from Riverdale, so I know him personally. Mm-hmm. And he's made a real success out of his books. And I think what's the reason for that is, first, that you have different sensibilities coming together. And they're honest. He's willing to tell the truth about a place. And people don't go to a travel guide for promotional fluff. If they want a brochure, they'll go to a travel agency. They want a critical appraisal of what a place does or doesn't have to offer, which is essentially what we're trying to do with our guides now. Going back to what we were saying before, we would feel a need to pan a place if it were a restaurant, a hotel that everybody considered the best, and we were obliged to pass some judgment on it. And if we needed to tell people that it wasn't up to its reputation, we have no hesitation. Now, many of the travel magazines are, an exception would be Condé Nast Traveler, can't really afford to be honest because they're dependent on their advertisers. we're publishing guides and really are obliged to no one but our own sense of integrity.
I thought the Condé Nast Traveler was taking kind of a hard view of certain elements of the travel industry, such as airline practices and things like that.
It has made some enemies, but it was a very new, refreshing thing to have a magazine telling the truth in the travel field, because traditionally travel writing promoted destinations. Everything was the oldest or the cutest or the best, and it was this new magazine coming in saying, wait a minute, there are, you know, problems and flaws in this world. And I think readers love it because they can trust what they read, but some of the advertisers obviously were ruffled by that.
Michael, what do you think about these travel books as opposed to the travel guides, the books written by people like Paul Theroux and Barry Lopez and John McPhee? These are kind of interesting. They really tell you the nitty-gritty of places. They don't list restaurants and hotels.
So. Sure. I think there's a real need for those books, and I think a serious traveler ought to read those books. There's a long tradition of them in Great Britain. If you go to any bookstore, there'll be shelves of personal guides, Victorian ladies conquering the wastes of Iceland with their tea sets and parasols. And that tradition is not American, but it's growing. And we are trying to take sections from those Paul Theroux-type books and include them in a new section in all our guides called Portraits, which are first-class, first-person narratives that try and bring a place to life and take tourists and turn them into travelers.
Now, are you based over in the Random House building?
Yes.
What kind of staff do you have? How big is your staff for your particular division?
Well, we have a staff of 24, and we also have an office of 5 in London, and they work on the European titles over there. Each editor has, if you divide 120, 140 titles among those editors, you can imagine how busy we all are.
How are they assigned?
Well, we try and give editors areas of the world so they become experts and develop contacts locally, and that's very important.
How does one become an editor of a travel guide?
Well, I guess I would suggest that someone start writing travel articles for magazines and newspapers. As with any kind of freelance writing, nobody's going to take you seriously until you can wave a portfolio of manuscripts in their face. So step one is to get published under any circumstances, which means not worrying about whether you get paid until you've gotten those first articles in print. And in many cases, you have to write on spec, and they may accept it and they may not. Keep feeding those articles, if you believe in what you're doing, to the right magazine. Find an editor who responds to you. Get your first check for your first article, and things start to flow from there.
So when you hire a travel editor to work at Fodor's, he goes in with his clips and things like that. You have some idea that he has been writing and has some knowledge about the industry.
Well, it would be important to distinguish between the editor who's working for us, who may not have much experience as a writer, and the writer who's writing the book out there in the field. Mm-hmm. The editors working in our office are not out traveling. We would hire an editor if he had a love of travel, had done some writing.
But he doesn't have to be a travel expert to be an editor of
travel. No, he just has to love words and know how to put them together and know a good sentence from a bad one. And the writers themselves obviously have to have proven themselves in print before we'll be interested in working with them.
Well, now, as these books are revised, do you use the same writer? Does the editor use the same writer? For example, we have, let's just say, Rome here. I mean, this obviously would be revised every 2 years, right? It's a big tourist spot.
Well, Rome is revised every year.
But every year.
This 89 book that you have with you was written from scratch. And in many cases, we're just finding new writers. And there are a lot of ways of finding writers, people who've published for the major magazines, who've published books, experts. we're using travel writers, but we're not limiting ourselves to travel writers. Very often you'd want to find somebody who was a writer who could also write about travel, because he would avoid the buzzwords of the trade and write with a freshness that many travel writers are, I guess, afraid of using because of what's been demanded of them from magazine work.
Now, as editorial director, it's your job to make sure each editor is consistent in, and each book is consistent as well in terms of its design and outlook.
Well, what I did, the very first thing when I arrived at Random House, was spend a few months developing a prototype. It was about 600 pages long and spelled out the order in which every piece of information would be presented and the order in which service material would be presented. This is all in a book that every editor has that's given to the writers. And it's not really confining, because now that everybody has a framework, they're free to be creative within that framework. And they're always told that if a book demands a different prototype, the demands of the book come before any kind of rigid structure. But the need for consistency is very strong. People come back to your books and they get used to the format, and we want them to be able to find the same information in the same place in every book.
Well, what's it like? What's your day like when you come in? What's the first thing you do? I guess you're in about 9 o'clock?
Well, a little before 9. Mm-hmm. And spend a lot of time signing bills, reading over manuscripts, because we're going through this process of change, of rewriting all the books. I've taken on myself, with the help of some other editors, of reading through everything that's been edited and copy edited and making sure that it's up to the level that we're looking for. And we've on many occasions handed things back to writers and to editors. We've delayed pub dates, which has cost us a lot of revenue, to make sure that what we were doing was up to the level we've been working towards.
Are you pretty well satisfied that you have covered the world?
Well, there are always new titles that we can work on. We have three or four new books coming up this spring. We have a guide to cruises and ports of call. We have a guide to Michigan, Wisconsin, coming out. We have a shopping guide to Europe on its way, guide to the Himalayas. There's always another book to be written.
It's a fascinating field, and these books are nicely designed. They're very attractive. I think I haven't actually used any of the new books, but I guess the proof is in the actual use. Take it with you, and that's, you can really tell if it's helpful. So,
one thing I could say to is that the sales over the last couple of months with these new covers and new format are way over 100% over what they were last year at the same time. So we're all delighted.
We must. Congratulations. You don't do these in hardcover,
right?
Do you?
No, we don't.
I would think a hardcover travel guide would be awfully heavy to take to London.
Well, the old photos used to be in hardback. People want something portable. And particularly if they take two guides or three, they want something they can slip into their suitcases.
It's a fascinating field, and you seem to like it a lot, Michael Spring. Thank you very much.
Welcome.